This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The Cold War was an era full of espionage, clandestine operations, stolen secrets, long cons, and one of the best spies in the United States was from right here in Indiana. Born in Danville in 1915, William King Harvey's life was extraordinary from the start. His mother was an English professor at a time when women weren't often seen outside the home. The two would hurl Shakespearean quotes at each other for fun. He finished college in 2 years and got a law degree 2 years later. His career took him from the FBI to the CIA, where he was later called America's James Bond by fellow intelligence officer Edward Lansdale. Author Steve Vogel released his book Betrayal in Berlin last year, which details the story of one of Harvey's most significant accomplishments. And he joins us now via Skype. Steve, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, Matt.
And if you have questions or comments for the show today, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll try to get it in front of Steve this hour. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Steve, just for some context and his connection to Indiana, real quick, let's start in college. What kind of student was Bill Harvey?
He was very bright. He really excelled. He was able to finish his coursework, as you mentioned, in 2 years, and got his law degree in 1937. And it's kind of interesting because you often associate the CIA with people coming from various Ivy League schools, but he turned out to be one of their best officers, and he attended Indiana State.
And then after college, his life was a little quiet for a while. What was he up to? What did he do right after college?
Well, he opened a law practice in Maysville, Kentucky, you know, just southeast of Cincinnati. He wasn't much of a glad hander. He was somebody who kind of was pretty brusque in his manner and didn't have much time for small talk and that sort of thing, and which isn't necessarily a good traits to have if you're trying to be an attorney in a small town. I guess in 1939, when World War II began after the Germans invaded Poland, he applied to the FBI. He was kind of bored with his legal work, and he wanted to get in the action somehow.
And that was kind of his, I don't know, it seemed like he wanted a piece of the war, essentially, right?
Yeah, exactly. Of course, the United States wasn't in the war at this point, but there was much involvement by the U.S. government, and including the FBI. There was concern about German espionage already at that time. And so the FBI was certainly hiring. J. Edgar Hoover had been director for a number of years at that point already. And the FBI was gearing up for its involvement in World War II in terms of protecting the United States against espionage.
So do you think he had being a spy on the brain long before he became one, or was it something that he just kind of found that he was good at?
You know, at that point, he was more, I don't know if you'd necessarily call him a spy. He was involved in counterintelligence. So he's essentially a law enforcement officer who, by virtue of his assignment to try to penetrate German espionage rings, became very well versed on espionage, and you know that would eventually lead to his career with the CIA. But he was based in New York for a time, and he was one of the main agents that was able to penetrate a ring that was run by the German military intelligence, the Abwehr, and they had a number of spies who were arrested. I think 37 spies in that ring. And he played a key part in that whole thing.
Did he get along with his coworkers at the FBI?
You know, Bill Harvey was not someone to ever kiss up to the bosses. So he managed to rub some people the wrong way. On the other hand, those who worked closest with him really admired his work ethic. I mean, he was just one of these guys who was doing 20-hour days and had this remarkable mind where he could just remember details. He would go through different files for different cases, and you know, go through hundreds of these different files. But then he might not need that information for days, weeks, months. But whenever he needed it, he would remember. His mind would connect, and he'd know where to go look for some information that could tie to what was in those files. And he was very good at making those connections, which is really one of the key elements of counterespionage. Basically, taking a series of seemingly random events or occurrences and making a connection and realizing that something bigger than just a couple of coincidences is going on.
But it wasn't his bureau. It was J. Edgar Hoover's bureau, and they had a bit of a contentious relationship. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, he was kind of an independent guy. And as mentioned, he didn't always cross his T's and dot his I's. And at one point, this was shortly after the war had ended, Harvey approved a bugging operation because his immediate superior was out of town. So the duty fell on Harvey, and on something like that, you're supposed to get approval from higher up. But Harvey, you know, decided it was worth doing, needed to be done. So he did it. He approved it. And when Harvey found out about that, he was furious because, you know, pretty much anything had to go through Harvey. Hoover himself. And Hoover didn't like agents with independent streaks. And that's something that Bill Harvey most assuredly had.
We're talking with Steve Vogel, author of the book Betrayal in Berlin, about Indiana spy Bill Harvey back in the early days of the Cold War. So what then got him, but we're not in the Cold War yet, quite. What got him fired from the FBI?
Well, Bill Harvey had a taste for liquor, alcohol, which certainly wasn't unusual among agents in the FBI then, and probably to some extent now as well. But he was a heavy drinker, and he was at a office party. This is what he'd been assigned to the headquarters in Washington. And one of the other agents in the office was going away, and there was some sort of going away party, and everybody at the party was drinking beer. And according to another officer agent who was there, Harvey didn't have any more or any less than anyone else at the party. But what happened was he headed home in his car, and he drove through Rock Creek Park in Washington, which is this big piece of wildland in the middle of the city. There's a parkway that goes through it, and he somehow ended up pulled off on the side of the road. A big rainstorm had come in, and his engine had flooded, and he couldn't get it restarted. And he essentially dozed off in his car and woke up about 8 or 10 hours later, you know, bright morning. And you know, his wife had wondered where the heck he was and called the FBI headquarters to see if they knew anything. And this was all a big no-no, you know, apart from, of course, the drinking and driving. In Hoover's eyes, the big offense was an FBI agent was never supposed to be out of communication for more than 2 hours. So if you were away from the office, you had to call in, or there had to be a number where the bureau could call you in case of any emergency. So he obviously in those days there was no phone in his car, so he Hoover disciplined him pretty severely because of that. Harvey's immediate superiors urged clemency because he was proving to be such an outstanding agent in many ways. He developed his specialty of studying Soviet intelligence, because this was sort of the beginnings of the Cold War, and the Soviets, with the war over, there was already a realization that we needed to keep an eye on the Soviets. They were keeping an eye on us. And but Hoover was unpersuaded by those arguments, and he recommended that, or he essentially decided that Harvey was going to be transferred back to Indianapolis, which at that time was nowhere near the center of action. Harvey wanted to be in the action for this burgeoning Cold War. and this was quite a demotion for him. So when he got that transfer, he quit rather than go.
And in we've got about two more minutes left in this segment, but he, after he resigned, the then fledgling, it wasn't even called the CIA at that point, right? They got wind that he was freed up, and so they came knocking.
That's right. Yeah, they had really only been created in the last couple of years, they had no counterintelligence expertise. So Harvey was the guy who knew Soviet espionage, which was certainly alive and well and underway in the United States at that point. So the CIA was quite eager to hire him, and he became one of their top counterintelligence people from the start.
So what was then the CIA like at that time?
You know, this was an agency that was pretty elite. It was full of these, you know, Eastern establishment blue bloods, guys from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. They wore trench coats. You know, they belonged to clubs. They played tennis and all that. And Harvey wasn't any of those things. But the CIA was wise enough to realize that Harvey could bring them. He might not have a trench coat, but he could bring them expertise that they sorely needed. So he was viewed a bit oddly by some of his colleagues, particularly his prodigious consumption of martinis at lunchtime and his habit of dozing off in the office after lunch and, you know, spinning his revolver at his the desk of his office. You know, most agency officers didn't carry weapons, but Bill Harvey liked his guns, and he kept them, and that kind of set him apart from his colleagues as well.
Yeah, he had kind of an obsession with guns. He almost always had two of them on his person at a time, right?
That's right, at least. I mean, sometimes far more than that. You know, and in his office, it was just like a small armory. Just, you know, and he would sit there cleaning his guns. You know, people would be sitting across from him, and he might be sighting the barrel of his weapon on whatever was nearby, including the guy in the chair.
Steve Vogel is the author of Betrayal in Berlin, the true story of the Cold War's most audacious espionage operation. It's out now wherever books are sold. And up next, we'll learn the lengths Bill Harvey and his counterparts took to gather intelligence on the Soviet Union. And do you have questions or comments on the Hoosier once called America's James Bond? Did you know about him? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the story of Danville native and Cold War spy Bill Harvey, I want to tell you about yesterday. We talked with some of the filmmakers behind the Indiana Humanities Inseparable film series on the real and perceived differences between rural and urban Indiana. We heard about neighbors getting together to start a small town newspaper, the family who integrated Valparaiso, and the couple from Bloomington who hired ex-offenders for their composting business, among others. You can find that and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In and be sure to subscribe. Today, we're spending one more segment with Steve Vogel, author of Betrayal in Berlin, the true story of the Cold War's most audacious espionage operation, which centers around Danville native Bill Harvey, who was a spy for the U.S. in the early days of the CIA. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. When we left off, Steve, we were talking about Bill's early days in the CIA. And this was when the CIA wasn't really getting as much intelligence as they had hoped for, correct?
That's right, particularly when it came to the Soviet Union, which around this time had developed its own nuclear weapons, thanks to espionage they conducted, where they'd stolen some of the atomic secrets from the Manhattan Project. And so there was a huge concern in the CIA and in the U.S. in general about the possibility of a surprise attack by the Soviets, particularly in Europe, They had kept a huge amount of forces in Eastern Europe, in East Germany and Czechoslovakia. And now that they were armed with nuclear weapons, there was concern there could be a nuclear Pearl Harbor.
So they were getting plenty on us, including our technology for nuclear weapons, and we weren't getting much on them. How were they getting it?
Well, the KGB had been certainly had decades of experience at this point in intelligence, and the CIA, being a new agency, didn't have that kind of experience. They had a number of spy rings operating in the U.S., and they had managed to penetrate the Manhattan Project with one of those rings. You know, and a lot of it was also operating in Western Europe, where you had U.S. forces stationed, including in Berlin and in West Germany. The Soviets had flooded the West with many agents, sleeper agents, in the years after, before and after World War II. So they had penetrated many different NATO and West German and French and you name it, different ministries were penetrated by the Soviets. And so they had a good read on what we were up to, but we didn't have much of a clue at all what they were. There was no U-2 overhead reconnaissance at that point, and obviously no satellites as well. So we were pretty much blind in this growing conflict.
And one of their men on the inside was Kim Philby. Who was he?
Kim Philby was one of the Cambridge spies who had been recruited while at, studying at Cambridge, along with some other young British students. And Philby had was serving in MI6, and he was had been assigned to Washington as a liaison officer for the British intelligence. And so Philby was very well situated to report back to Moscow all kinds of sensitive information about what was going on in Washington or in London for that matter. And among his contacts, by virtue of Bill Harvey's position in counterintelligence, was Harvey himself. So they knew each other in the late 40s, early 50s.
And then Kim Philby threw this dinner party where Bill Harvey's opinion of him kind of turned. Tell us about that.
Yeah. One of Philby's fellow Cambridge spies, this gentleman named Guy Burgess, was a complete drunk himself. And he had showed up at this dinner party where Bill Harvey was in attendance, along with his wife, Libby, whom he'd met in Indiana, and they were now living in Washington. And Libby Harvey was drinking as well. And Guy Burgess ended up drawing this sketch, a rather obscene sketch, that was very insulting to Libby Harvey. Bill Harvey is furious and, you know, started swinging his fists and, you know, was on top of Burgess, throttling him, and Philby and others were trying to pull him off. And, you know, the whole dinner party obviously ended a bit abruptly. And Harvey began thinking more about Philby and who exactly this guy Burgess was. And as mentioned, he had this remarkable mind, and he started putting different pieces of information about Philby's background, together with the fact that the U.S. had recently learned about some penetration of British intelligence, and possibly somebody at the British embassy in Washington who was reporting to the Soviets, and that was Donald McLean, who had who was at the British embassy, and he had fled upon getting word from Philby that he was under suspicion. And Harvey put two and two together and realized that it was Philby who had warned Donald McLean about this. And he wrote this blockbuster memo, Harvey did, that essentially named Philby as a spy. And this was, you know, an earth-shaking development, because Philby was so well situated in Washington. Nobody had suspected him until Bill Harvey, who was just had a great nose for a spy, did. And it turned out Harvey was right. And that, of course, upped his prestige in Washington in intelligence circles.
Well, then what happened with Kim Philby after that?
Well, Philby was in a kind of this Netherland for a long time because he was recalled back to London, but they didn't have enough hard evidence on him to convict him or to even put him on trial for that matter. And plus the British were sort of wary of having a trial, which would be very embarrassing. So he was forced to resign from MI6, but he kind of floated around on the periphery for a number of years after that. There was growing suspicion that Philby and McLean and Burgess might not be the only ones, that they might have more moles who had penetrated British intelligence.
So Bill Harvey takes down Kim Philby, and which gets him a lot of prestige. So how then did Bill Harvey end up in Berlin?
Well, Harvey was very concerned about the lack of information we had on the Soviets. He and some other people at the CIA, including Frank Rowlett, who was this Virginian who was one of the heroes of World War II, a code breaker who had broken some of the Japanese codes, they began to try to think of a way that they could intercept Soviet communications in Europe, where you had the Red Army positioned in Germany, in East Germany. And the British had done something like this on a smaller scale in Vienna, which was also, like Berlin, an occupied city after the war, divided between the four powers. So there was an opportunity in Berlin because it was the complete communication center for all of Eastern Europe. So all the lines, it was like the hub of a wheel. You had all these spokes coming into Berlin, and you had the Red Army headquarters positioned near Berlin. And they began to wonder if in the divided city of Berlin, where the American forces operated, you know, very close proximity to the Soviets, whether there'd be an opportunity to tap into it. To Soviet communications, and they, at Harvey's urging, there were some investigations made. The British were working on a similar type project, and before too long, Bill Harvey and his British counterpart Peter Lund had been given the green light to tap into the Soviet lines. And the way they were going to have to do that was to dig a tunnel into Soviet-held territory. So this was kind of a bold move. They were going to have to dig a tunnel a quarter mile into East Berlin and then tap into these huge Soviet communication lines. We're talking trunk cables that were carrying hundreds and thousands of lines of communication.
We're talking with Steve Vogel, author of the book Betrayal in Berlin, which centers in part on Indiana native Bill Harvey, who was a spy in the early days of the Cold War for the CIA, and in the early days of the CIA, for that matter. And so this was a literal physical operation where they dug through the ground and then dug up to tap into wires, essentially, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, Kate. Big cables, and this was a project beyond the scope of what the CIA could do, so they had to bring in the Army Corps of Engineers. A secret team was assembled. You know, they practiced in New Mexico, and then they were snuck into Berlin to hand dig a tunnel that would have to be lined with steel and you know, big enough for people to operate in and holding all this communications equipment. It was an amazing operation, and it took this team of engineers about 6 months to hand dig it, you know, under the feet literally of Soviet and East German guards who were patrolling over their heads, and they were, you know, they could hear the footsteps above, and they were operating from a warehouse, a U.S. Army warehouse that had been constructed pretty close to the border between the American sector and the Soviet sector. And, all kinds of eyes on the Soviet side watching what the Americans were up to.
See, as I read about this, I thought maybe they would go a little deeper than that. And so that there wasn't any chance of being caught from above, but they weren't that deep at all. And I guess the reason for that would be to hand dig that deep would be very difficult. And I guess hand digging also cut down on the noise.
No, the real problem was the water table. If they dug too deep, they were going to run into water. And the water would pretty much sabotage the tunnel because the tunnel had to carry all this communications gear. It would be very, very difficult to dig, you know, because there'd be constant flooding for one thing. And then even if they succeeded in digging it, the water would constantly threaten the communications equipment. So that's why they had to stay high. And the water table was even closer to the surface than they even thought it would be. So that's why they ended up basically only having about 8 feet of cover above their heads.
So how much intelligence was the U.S. able to get from this?
Well, once they succeeded with the British were the real tapping experts. Once the British team tapped into these three trunk cables, they were collecting an awesome flood. It was as if they'd struck oil. They're a bunch of wildcatters, and they're practically drowning in the amount of material they're collecting because there were some thousand plus communications, phone calls, teletype communications that they were collecting on a daily basis. All these being recorded on these big Ampex recorders who were back in the American warehouse, but also they had a team that was listening to a lot of the conversations live because they were looking for anything that needed to be immediately acted upon, any sign that the tunnel had been betrayed or any sign that the Soviets were in the process of preparing for some kind of attack. So they were getting all the Red Army headquarters communications. They were also receiving some of the Soviet KGB and GRU, which was military intelligence, getting some of their communications as well. So they were picking up a ton of information and getting a real order of battle of what the Red Army capabilities in Eastern Europe were.
Was the tunnel ever discovered?
Yes. I mean, and this is one of the great ironies of the whole thing was that the British spy George Blake, who's also a major figure in this book, was in on the secret from the start, and he was one of the very few British MI6 officers involved in the tunnel as it was being planned and then put into place. But Blake's position was so sensitive that the KGB, once they were alerted about the tunnel, they were afraid to take action to stop the tunnel, because if they did, they'd already lost Kim Philby, and George Blake was now proving himself as valuable, if not more valuable than Philby. They didn't want to risk losing him.
So how much of a turning point was this operation in the Cold War?
Well, the main thing that the tunnel achieved was at this time of real paranoia, of real fear, Eisenhower thinking that maybe he would have to launch a preemptive attack against the Soviets because he feared that if the Soviets launched one against the United States, we wouldn't have time to react. So what the tunnel provided was clear account that the Soviets, in fact, were not planning some sort of attack. They had no immediate plans to launch their own nuclear strike against U.S. forces or into Western Europe. That helped ease some of the tensions. And by the time the tunnel was discovered publicly by the Soviets, the U-2 began its flights almost immediately afterwards. So we soon had other means of keeping tabs on the Soviets. Not too many years after that, the satellite reconnaissance. So the tunnel kind of filled in this middle period when the United States was essentially blind, and before we had overhead reconnaissance or the NSA operating with all the intercepts that they take in. The tunnel was kind of this first mass collection of communications by the United States, and it gave us essentially reassurance and helped keep the peace, in my view.
Got less than a minute left. Time flies when you're having fun. How then was Bill Harvey fired from the CIA years later?
Well, you know, Harvey was the toast of the town after the tunnel operation because of the value of the information and the audaciousness of the whole thing. And he, you know, he felt he was on a line of promotion to higher glory in the CIA, but his drinking had not diminished. In fact, had grown heavier over the years. And he was then introduced to President John F. Kennedy in the early 1960s as America's James Bond, and was sucked into the Cuban Missile Crisis and some of the assassination attempts against Castro, and ended up with his drinking, just alienating a lot of people.
We'll have to leave it at that. Steve Vogel is the author of Betrayal in Berlin, which is out now wherever you get books. And there's a lot more to the story of Hoosier Bill Harvey than we got to. But Steve, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Matt. Thank you.
Up next, Indiana celebrating 100 years of women's suffrage. Tomorrow marks the anniversary of our ratification of the 19th Amendment, and we'll welcome Leah Namias, former history teacher and current director of programming for Indiana Humanities, to fill us in on Indiana's role in the suffrage movement. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Tomorrow marks the 100th anniversary of Indiana's ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. Of course, it wasn't officially adopted to the U.S. Constitution until August of that year, but Indiana Humanities is marking the occasion by announcing a series of events that'll be held tomorrow and throughout the year, culminating in a women's suffrage block party at the Eitel-Georg Museum in Indianapolis on August 22nd. Here with more is Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities, Leah Namias. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Well, so we're celebrating Indiana's ratification of the 19th Amendment, which is a sort of a more specific point in history.
Yeah. So, you know, for those of you who, like, remember your high school civics class, in order to make a change to the Constitution, you have to have 2/3. Oh, my gosh. I'm a former history teacher, so I should have this down pat. But you have to have 2/3 plus one states ratify an amendment. So Indiana was the 26th. State to ratify the 19th Amendment. That ratification process got kicked off in 1918 when the U.S. Congress finally, like, approved the 19th Amendment. Then it got sent out to the states. And so we thought it would be worthwhile to focus on just the story of Indiana because, of course, 70 years, 1920 was the end of, like, a 70-year process in Indiana where women were trying all different kinds of things to get the right to vote.
So Seneca Falls, historic Seneca Falls, well, that was 1848, and so
1848 in upstate New York is, like, the first time in American history that there's a formal call for women's right to vote, and they model it after the Declaration of Independence. It's called the Declaration of Sentiments. And you've all heard the names of people who were there. So that's Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Frederick Douglass is there, all kinds of important people, Lucretia Mott. Well, in 1851 in Indiana, in Dublin. Just 3 years later. So if you know where Dublin is, congratulations. It's in East Central Indiana,
Wayne County,
which is like the heart of the Quaker community here. And if you kind of know Indiana history or American history, it's not surprising that the first call for women's rights really comes out of the Quaker community, because the Quakers were thinking about all different kinds of ways to reform society and had very different ideas than the dominant society about women's kind of full equality. So in 1851, there is the first women's rights convention. Now, they don't just ask for the right to vote. They ask for property laws. Women should be able to own property in their own name. They should be able to get a great education. They should get paid equally for equal work. So they're pretty forward looking. We haven't even hit all of those requests so far, but that's the first time. And so a lot of historians are very nervous to say it was the first of something, but pretty much it's widely considered one of the earliest state-based suffrage organizations. And those folks meet annually pretty much up until the Civil War. And I'll fill you in on the rest of the story if you want to hear it. But I should take a breath. So.
Well, I do want to hear it. But okay, so going back to Seneca Falls, you said Frederick Douglass was there?
Yeah.
So how diverse was the Indiana movement for women's suffrage?
That's a good question, because I think a lot of folks know that just because the 19th Amendment went into effect in 1920, that depending on where you lived, what your race was would affect whether you had access to the ballot. But in Indiana, what we know is that the suffrage movement was pretty diverse from the beginning. There are documented records that show us in those 1850s conventions that African-American women are there, and they talk and they ask, hey, when you're talking about voting rights, are you talking about my voting rights? And they're being told yes. We know that later, skipping forward to kind of the last decade of the suffrage movement, in 1912, there are African-American branches of the Equal Suffrage Association, which is a statewide organization. The first meeting of that in Indianapolis took place in the home of Madam C.J. Walker. F.B. Ransom, if you know Ransom Place, was the first president. But he immediately turned over his presidency to a woman who named Carrie Barnes Ross, who's like one of those people that we have to know more about, right? Because we know her name. She's involved in all kinds of issues, schools, NAACP, as well as suffrage. She's kind of the first like mover and shaker of that particular club. But anyway, from the beginning, the suffrage movement is diverse in Indiana. And it's not just diverse in terms of race. It's diverse in terms of social class. You have working class women, middle class women, rich women. Religious diversity. There are Jewish suffrage associations that we can document in Indiana. Geographically very diverse. I was just corresponding with some folks in Miami County, and there were six different branches of the Women's Franchise League in Miami County, which, I mean, so like this wasn't just a big city. This wasn't just like ladies in white dresses with big fancy hats. This was a pretty broad movement, and suffragists were really intentional about getting as many people on board. Well, one of my favorite things, like images of the suffrage movement in Indiana, is that pretty much the suffragists of the 19th century are just trying to convince male legislators. They're just like, if we just go and we petition and we talk politely and we, you know, don't make a ruckus, we will convince them that this is the right thing to do. That doesn't work in Indiana. And so the kind of early 20th century suffragists are kind of inspired by what's going on in England, where women are like really radical, you know, going on hunger strikes and chaining themselves to buildings. And in Indiana, they don't quite go that far, but that's not surprising. But they say, well, we got to take it to the streets. We've just got to build a mass movement. So we're going to get in cars and we're going to drive around the state and we're going to wear sashes and buttons. And we're just going to like go through every little town. And of course, the idea of a woman driving a car is already a spectacle. And I think the suffragists were really good at being like, we're going to turn ourselves into a spectacle so that you pay attention. And they're doing things that other activist movements do for the rest of the 20th century. And I think that's pretty cool.
Can we do a weekly history segment with you?
Yes, I would love that. I don't know as much about everything as I do about this, but I'm so excited about this history.
It really shows, and I appreciate you coming on to talk about it. But okay, so the Indiana movement started in 1851, and 30 years later, an amendment passed to Indiana's constitution.
Yeah, so in Indiana, Indiana women won and lost the right to vote twice before 1920. Mm. So the first time is in the 1880s when, you know, those polite petitions actually kind of work and they convince the General Assembly to take up the suffrage question. And a bill is introduced in 1881 and is approved. And state constitution says, well, you have to approve it again. And the General Assembly only meets every other year. So we'll see you again in 1883. And when they return, that vote has just disappeared from the legislative record. And so, you can imagine maybe what has happened. It'd be a great short story prompt, right? Like what happened to the legislative record, but it disappears. And so it just doesn't go into effect. And in that time, the opponents of suffrage kind of rally and are able to kill it. And in 1917, Indiana also passed a series of suffrage laws that would have allowed Indiana women to vote in local and state elections. But long story short, opponents of suffrage sued, and a judge agreed, and so all those laws were thrown out. And so it really meant a lot to have a federal amendment because that guaranteed women the right to vote. It says it takes that power away from the states.
We're talking about the 100th anniversary of Indiana's ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. We're with Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities, Leah Namias. And so there were ways that Indiana women made their way into politics before they actually got the right to vote.
Yeah.
How did they sort of make their way in?
So I want to credit the historian Anita Morgan, who teaches at IUPUI, and she is having a year because she has been researching this her entire career. She has a book coming out about the suffrage movement in Indiana. So be looking for that if you want to know more. But the Women's Franchise League was founded by Grace Julian Clark, another Quaker. She's from the east side of Indianapolis. Her father and grandfather were congressmen. They were abolitionists. I think her father or her grandfather introduced the first bill for suffrage in the U.S. Congress. So we have a lot to be proud of. She starts organizing groups of women who are going to, yes, they're going to petition for the right to vote. They're going to go talk to the General Assembly, but they also work on a whole bunch of other reform issues. So they are using the skills that they learned in trying to convince people to give women the right to vote to make change on education, child labor laws, on all kinds of public policy questions. And I think for me, it's really important for folks to understand that just because women didn't have the official right to vote doesn't mean that they aren't active participants in society and trying to shape and make change, whether through a judicial, you know, or through a legislative process or outside of a legislative process. And one of the things that's really cool for the suffrage centennial is that the state commission, which is headed by the lieutenant governor, Suzanne Crouch, they have figured out where the offices in the state house were, where these women had offices. And just the idea that women who did not have the right to vote had offices in the state house so they could just go lobby a general assembly member at a drop of a hat. They figured out where those offices are, and they're going to put up a permanent plaque. And so if you take a tour of the state house after this week, you will learn this story, and we will kind of have, you know, it's a way to kind of think about women's participation in society.
That's so significant. And I love that it's happening, and it's the right year to do it.
Yes. So, you know, it's also an election year. So it's a time for everyone to just like get into civics a little bit. It's a census year. If you are a social studies teacher, this is a pretty exciting year for you.
Indeed. Okay. So how are we marking the occasion? There are a number of events happening throughout the state.
So if you visit IndianaSuffrage100.org, you can find an event calendar with events happening all over the state, and you can add your own event. But big stuff happening tomorrow. There'll be things are happening all over the state, but at the state house, there'll be a special event with the lieutenant governor, and there'll be a choir that's singing, and there's going to be some Girl Scouts. It'll be really cool. And then there will be special resolutions introduced in the House and in the Senate to mark this occasion. So that's the stuff that's going to be happening at the state house. If you follow Indiana Suffrage 100 on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, there will also be a whole bunch of things. We're kind of promoting the idea of 19 actions you can take to commemorate the 19th Amendment. So follow along to find that out.
And so then there are other events that are happening throughout the state at local local libraries and places like that?
Yeah. So there's speakers events. There's a traveling exhibit that the Indiana Historical Society is circulating. There's going to be teacher workshops that the State Museum is doing across the state. Two things. You mentioned the block party. So that's actually going to be at the Eideljorg, the State Museum, and the Historical Society. It's like an extravaganza on August 22nd. So more information will be coming out that later. That's basically the closest Saturday to the day that the 19th Amendment went into effect. And then on March 7th, if you're just a geek about history, there's a conference called Hoosier Women at Work, and there'll be researchers presenting their research on Indiana women's participation in the suffrage movement, but other kinds of civil rights movements as well. That will take place at the Indiana Historical Society. And again, if you follow us on suffrage or visit IndianaSuffrage100.org, you can find information about that conference.
Can you tell me a little bit more of what you know about Dr. Anita Morgan's book?
So her book is called We Must Be Fearless, and then it has a subtitle I can't remember. That's a quote from one of the suffragists writing to another suffragist who's like, we just got to do this. We got to be impolite. We've got to like really say what we want. So that book is being published by the Indiana Historical Society Press, and I believe that it is supposed to make its debut by that conference in March. So I'm really hopeful because I think that a lot of people will want to dig into this history. If you get a chance to hear Dr. Morgan speak, she's actually going to be at the State House event as well. And she's part of the Speakers Bureau. You should. She knows so much more than I do. She's read the letters. She's read the historic documents. And she's the one who really pointed out that the suffrage movement here in Indiana is kind of an amazing story, but that also Indiana women were all over the national suffrage movement, but we kind of lost the stories. We all know Susan B. Anthony. Well, her hand-picked biographer was Ida Husted Harper, who's from Terre Haute, Indiana. And Susan, you know, those early suffragists are like, oh, we're about all to die off, and we still have not got the 19th Amendment. We got to write down our story so that younger women get involved in this battle. And she handpicks a journalist from, you know, Terre Haute, Indiana to do that. And that kind of story is typical. There are Indiana women all over the suffrage movement, and it's time to learn their stories.
And there are things being given to schools to mark this anniversary as well.
So we, Indiana Humanities, collaborated with the State Commission, and that's more complicated than you need to know, to basically design and distribute a timeline poster of kind of some of the key milestones from 1851 to 1920. So that was designed and circulated. It just went out, I think, this past week to every school and library in the state. While supplies last, you can actually request a copy for free for your organization. And again, IndianaSuffrage100.org. There's just a whole page called Resources. That's where you'll find it. So it's really fun to see those requests come in. It's all these like League of Women Voters, historical societies, classrooms. I'm a former classroom teacher, and I know that a teacher will laminate a poster and use it for 20 years. It's a good investment. So that's what we decided to do.
I'm curious, since you were a teacher, what was up in your classroom that you can remember?
Oh, my God.
if you can remember.
We had a whole lesson. Oh, my students all wanted, like, they just wanted to see pictures of the presidents, like, in order that they were. So, like, I went to a teacher supply classroom store and bought those. I had my students, when we were learning about yellow journalism and kind of, you know, the lead up to the Spanish-American War, they had to write headlines kind of learning what they had about the war and yellow journalism. And I promised them the best ones I will laminate. And so that's a good motivator, is if you laminate something. So we have those up in the classroom, too.
And so as part of what you taught, did you teach U.S. history?
I taught U.S. history. Yes, I taught high school U.S. history, not in Indianapolis, down in Charlotte, North Carolina. I taught AP U.S. history, IB History of the Americas. You know, all the things.
But you touched on women's suffrage? Probably not for as long as you'd like.
Not for as long as you'd like. And actually, I also then worked at a history organization in a previous job where we looked at this question of how you make change. And we looked at the idea of the Constitution as a living document that was designed in order to be changed. And we looked at kind of that question of the long march. And I think this is a history that a lot of people go, yep, ladies in big hats having tea parties. I got it. And they kind of assume it's a foregone conclusion, and that's not the story at all. I think we can learn about resilience. We can learn about patience. We can learn about changing tactics when something's not working. We can learn about, I mean, frankly, the arguments that people made against women in public life in 1900 are not that different than they're making in 1920 about, well, how could you be a good wife and mother if you're outside the home and women don't have their own ideas? They're just going to do what their husbands and fathers tell them to do. So all kinds of those arguments are sadly not so far gone in some quarters. And so it's inspiring to look back at that history and see how women kind of worked through and around those issues and didn't give up.
Yeah, you mentioned the foregone conclusion. Let's not forget, this took 72 years from Seneca Falls to 1920. And that is a lifetime. I mean,
there were a couple of generations of suffragists. It makes me sad to think that people in Seneca Falls weren't around to see this happen. It also took another 45 years before we had federal laws that said that you could not discriminate based on race in this country. And so, you know, in Indiana, I think a lot of people assume, and this is actually one of the, we're funding some research, and so we're trying to learn more about this, but there are historic photographs of women out on November 2nd, 1920, across the state, standing in line to vote. We have who went out and voted, or who went out and registered to vote. We know African-American women were voting in Indiana. And that's always something I like to clarify, because I know that, you know, in other parts of the country, that wasn't the case. But in Indiana, as far as we can tell from the historical record, although there's more research to be done, people did go out and vote regardless of race.
Let's quickly recap the event happening tomorrow with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch.
Yeah. Free and open to the public. You can be at the State House. It starts at 9 a.m. I think the joint resolutions start around 10 a.m. We'll be sharing that stuff on our social media. And if you visit our online calendar, you can find other suffrage events happening tomorrow around the state or anytime this year.
Hard to believe it's only been 100 years, but I'm glad you're marking the occasion. Leah Namias is the Director of Programs and Community Engagement for Indiana Humanities. Leah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our technical director is Adam Gross. Our podcast is wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll talk about insurance for farmers in Indiana. This year, the Indiana legislature will consider changes that could help out Hoosier farmers, especially when it comes to health insurance. We'll be talking with Samantha Horton, our Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter, as well as Randy Cron, president of the Indiana Farm Bureau. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.